Concluding our program today, longtime OMO contributor Norm Diamond interviews Alex Diamond. Alex Diamond has been teaching in Columbia for the past several years. Until recently, he'd been living in a remote community, long an area of struggle between guerrillas, paramilitaries, and the government. He just published an essay in the NACLA report on the implementation of the peace accords between the guerrillas and the government. We'll post a link to that essay on our website. Currently, Diamond is a PhD student in sociology at the University of Texas, Austin. And full disclosure, if you haven't already guessed or assumed, Norm and Alex are father and son. Norm?
Yeah, but which is which, Tom? Let the listeners figure it out. Our theme is Columbia, and with Tom's introduction, clearly Alex is leading an adventuresome life. It's been a while since you've been on the radio. Welcome. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you.
So Colombia, for decades, the U.S. government's closest ally in Latin America. In this country, probably most associated with violence, the reputation of just ongoing violence, murder of trade union leaders, murder of journalists, etc. It would not surprise me if in our conversation those two themes are linked somehow. That is, the theme of violence and the connection to U.S. government policy. Tom introduced you as a sociologist, Alex. Within sociology, you're an ethnographer. Tell us what that means, and then we'll get into what you've been doing and how that bears on our larger questions.
Well, the idea of ethnography is that we learn particular things about people and we come to a deeper understanding of social structures and how people live from interacting with people within their daily lives. Interviews are an important part of ethnography, but not just interviews. Certainly not quantitative research, but actually being with people in their daily lives, in the habitat they live in, seeing, not just asking them what they do, but seeing what they do, seeing their practices, and even participating.
Kind of participation, participant observer status in this very contentious zone. I guess tell us about Briseño. Tell us about where you've been, social structure, economics. How do people live there before we get into why it's so important to know about that area?
Well, Briseño is a small municipality. The population is about 9,000 in northern Antioquia department of Colombia. And it's particularly crucial to my research because it was an area that had a lot of violence. The FARC which are the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia.
That's the guerrilla movement.
The guerrilla movement have been there. It originated in the southern eastern part of the country, but they've been there historically since 1981 with constant presence, and more recently been fighting with paramilitaries, like Tom mentioned. But the economy of Briseño was about 90% based on coca, which is the plant that's used to make cocaine. And this has historically been a major driver of the conflict, at least in terms of arming groups, both the guerrillas and paramilitaries, financing them. And it was also the place where the Colombian government chose to launch a pilot substitution program for coca, which was negotiated in the peace accords with the guerrillas.
Taking one step back, and then we want to get to the peace accords. This is just a question out of real curiosity. Was there any kind of a difference between how the guerrilla movement and the paramilitaries related to the production of cocaine, to the growth of coca?
So that's a contentious issue. First, in terms of Colombia as a whole, the guerrillas were resistant to the coca. They even prevented in the late 70s and early 80s at times, prevented campesinos from cultivating coca. And then sort of realized that that was, as the most profitable crop available, that was the only option they had. And they began regulating production and trade. Now, that brought with it a lot of violence, but generally around the country and in Briseño, the guerrillas did support local populations, including, for example, mandating particular salaries for people who worked with the coca. The paramilitaries historically actually forced, and in Briseño, forced people to grow coca, were much more likely to use violence around it. And in Briseño, for example, they often actually did not have money, so they wouldn't pay people for 4 or 5 months. They would force people to continue producing. They wouldn't pay them. And a lot of violence, they prevented people from selling to other groups or other even private individuals. So they would kill or threaten people who tried to sell their coca outside.
So this is a zone of small farmers, basically. You're not talking about large estates somehow, not industrial agricultural production.
That's a good clarification, yeah. It's all small farmers, many of whom do not own their own property. So there was a lot of tenant farming as well, but small-scale production.
So the peace accords, I mean, it's extremely interesting. The peace accords then impact the economic events and people's possibilities for making a living, even potentially the social structure in the communities.
Yeah, the peace accords, it's really an amazing document, about 300 pages. I won't claim to have read the whole thing. But they have six parts, and the parts that are most important to my research are part one is rural reform, an integral rural reform. So a lot of infrastructural development, education, healthcare, roads is a major issue. And part four is crop substitution, not just coca. There's also marijuana and poppies in Colombia, but it's mainly coca. So the peace accords themselves were a recognition that rural violence and the guerrilla struggle has historically come out of state abandonment of rural areas, not just abandonment, I would say campesino dispossession. So there were all these parts of it that were meant, not just the parts that have to do with transitional justice or what the disarming guerrillas get from the agreement, but also having to do with the growth of and social investment in rural Colombia.
One of the things I remember about Colombia is the huge, you mentioned displacement, the huge internal, well, the population that's been moved out of their traditional areas. For what and by whom?
Well, I think now there's about 7 million people in Colombia who are registered as internally displaced. The number would be higher if you take into account how many people are actually displaced. It's a huge number. It's generally violence, people who have had to leave because of violence. A figure that large, each displacement has its own story. A lot are very specific economic means, getting people out of areas so paramilitary groups, to give a little bit of history. Paramilitary groups were founded and kind of operate in terms of a counterinsurgent discourse, so that they're supposed to address specifically the guerrilla groups that have existed in the country since 1964, really, of which the FARC is only one. But they've historically been used, and they were controlled by large landowners, they've historically been used, this is just one example of displacements, to get people off lands that have some kind of resource that wealthy large Colombian landowners want. Whether that's gold, which is a major issue in Briceño, whether that's clearing out land to found African palm plantations, whether that's...
What's the African palm for?
Well, it's a bit ironic. This is not an issue in Briceño, but in many parts of Colombia it is, that it's biofuel. So this is European attempts to address global warming, but not just in Colombia. Colombia is probably the place where it's manifested itself in the most violent way. But in a lot of producers in Africa and Indonesia, they've just cleared out huge swaths of jungle to grow these palm trees, and they extract oil from them.
Destroying trees, destroying habitat for ecological or supposedly ecological kinds of purposes.
Right. These are the ironies of capitalism.
They are. And so it's quite fascinating, going back to Briceño and the crop substitution programs, when we read in the papers something so simple as, well, they're converting the production of root material for cocaine, they're converting it to something somehow more salubrious, growing bananas or growing avocados or something like that. Really, there's a huge story behind it, and there are really large social and economic issues, and there's, for that matter, there's a real devastation as well. So, back, tell us more about the crop substitution program. It's part of the peace accords, and you've been there on the ground. What's actually been happening?
So just quickly, the program, which I think is really well designed, gives a year's worth of subsidy payments to families register in the program, they sign an agreement with the government, and they get a year's worth of subsidy payments basically to feed themselves. It's about $350 a month in U.S. dollars to feed themselves as they transition to other crops. So they pull out all their coca. Well, they get the first payment, they pull out all their coca, and they basically have food for a year. And during that year, they're supposed to get goods, not money, but goods to develop other projects on three levels. So there's family farms, short-term productive projects, and long-term productive projects. And the idea is that within the first 2 months, they implement the family farms project to ensure that they have things to eat, subsistence agriculture. Then within the first year, they're supposed to have short-term productive projects going so that when the payments actually end within that year, they have something they can make money off of. Short-term productive projects are like crops that produce quickly. So an example would be they can plant blackberries and be getting a harvest within, I don't know, like 7 months, something like that. And then once the first year ends, they're supposed to implement and get the goods for long-term productive projects. The idea is that this is the economic activity that's going to replace the coca.
Just one quick clarification, something that's intrigued me. When you talk about blackberries, that's obviously not a subsistence crop. Is part of the plan, whether it's working or not, and you still have to tell us about that, is part of the plan to convert them into producing for export somehow?
My understanding of blackberries is that they're not exported outside of the country, but they're sold as either the berry itself or in fruit pulp, which is used to make juice.
So taking subsistence farmers and integrating them more solidly in the market in any case, although cocaine obviously was...
I don't know that it's actually integrating them more into the market, because in the time of the coca, which was until like a year and a half ago, or 2 years ago basically, Briseño was all coca producing. That was the economy, well, 90%. There was actually a lot less subsistence agriculture, and people started buying food because the coca was profitable enough. And particularly in areas that were controlled by the paramilitaries, people just used all their land to grow coca. So within the agreement, there's actually a push, as negotiated by the FARC, a push back to subsistence agriculture. It's more integrating people within a licit market rather than an illicit market.
Okay, so you've described the plan. How's it working?
Basically, the campesinos complied with the agreement. They uprooted their crops very quickly. They were supposed to do it within the first 2 months. They did it earlier, and they sort of sat on their hands waiting for the productive projects to come. And just now, basically a year and 4 months after they pulled out their coca, just now they're getting the first productive projects that they were promised within 2 months, which are the family farms. So not the projects that are supposed to give them money. It's been a really mismanaged process with incredible delays. And as a result, the coca economy disappeared immediately. They pulled it all out, and there's been nothing to replace it. So the economy of the region has collapsed completely.
People are hard hit. These are people you've been living among and knowing and making friends with. What's their response been?
As a researcher, actually, it's amazing because there's a lot of people with a lot of free time. It's not ideal, but people are happy to talk, and you go visit people, and it's in very rural areas. There's a lot of sitting around.
And motivated. If people have the free time, then I imagine there's some unhappiness as well.
Very, very much so. I think there have been three responses. One response is a lot of people have left the area. A lot of people have had to go elsewhere to look for work, whether that's entire families or traditionally the man of the family might go to find daily work. They're called jornales.
Just to clarify, this is a result. We're talking about the results of government failure to comply with the peace accords, essentially.
Exactly, yeah. And it's clear. There's no doubt about that. So many people are leaving. Some people have been able to plant other crops, have done it with their savings, have borrowed money, but the local economy still has completely collapsed. That's not a mischaracterization. And then a third and particularly distressing result is that in the wake of the peace agreement, FARC dissident groups have popped up. There's a narrative about them that it's ex-FARC combatants who wanted to continue the armed life and wanted to continue working in illegal coca economies and often illegal mining economies. But in Briceño, at least, that's not the case. What it's been is young, particularly young men who don't have work, who previously would have been working within the coca economy, who are angry at the government, and the dissident group that has popped up in Briceño is now paying, which the FARC didn't do before. So they're joining, and it's growing rapidly. And that's a very distressing thing for a region that thought that it had gotten past this armed group presence.
So we've read about the peace accords. Here, the government's failure to comply is generating a new guerrilla group, a new insurgent movement in the area you're studying and surrounded by.
Essentially, yes. And historically, the armed groups, not just the guerrillas, but also paramilitaries, have been driven to a large extent by a whole lot of people who don't have better opportunities, who are joining because that's a source of, in some cases, income, particularly the paramilitaries, but food, status. And it's the same in this case.
Well, there's a lot I'd like to ask about that, including gender kinds of issues. The FARC itself, of course, was both female and male. You described this as young men in particular. But let's hold that question because we also promised that we'd talk about the U.S. role. Is there U.S. pressure, or how do you understand U.S. policy vis-a-vis all this?
Well, that's very important, especially speaking to an American audience, which I assume I'm doing now. The
tens of thousands of listeners are eagerly awaiting your word, yes.
Well, there's currently in the political climate in Colombia, there was a presidential election. The new president, Iván Duque, took power August 7th. And he's come out against crop substitution. And recently, I think about a week ago, his defense minister came out against crop substitution. And the alternative is forced eradication, which is basically the military going in and pulling out the crops, and also aerial fumigation, which is using glyphosate, a dangerous chemical.
Spraying deadly poisons from the air while the military also moves in, yeah.
Right. So Briceño historically had seen both of those strategies, and what people told me was that people just go back and plant more coca because they're left with, as we're seeing now, they're left without their productive activity, and coca is the crop that they can grow and quickly get money from. So that basically these programs of eradication and fumigation take food out of their children's mouths without offering any sort of alternative. That's why substitution is important. But to get to your question, the U.S. has always pushed for both eradication and fumigation. In 2015, Colombia stopped using glyphosate. They stopped aerial fumigation because it was shown to be carcinogenic. I think there's some debate over that now. It's certainly terrible for water, for children.
No,
for
United
other
Nations
crops.
Has recently declared, acknowledged glyphosate as carcinogen.
And recently, the U.S. has pushed more and more. And now,
why? How do you understand that? There was the pretense that we were eradicating drugs, and what really was going on was an attack on insurgent movements. But why do they continue now that there are peace accords? Why would the U.S. continue that kind of repressive approach to the population of Colombia?
Well, one thing is this rush and need to get numbers. Not because substitution doesn't work, because I think it would work if it was properly implemented, but because it hasn't been implemented on a wide scale. Coca cultivation has actually gone up in Colombia, and that's something that Trump talks about and has used as an excuse to push for forced eradication and fumigation. Another thing that I don't think we're going to have time to get into, but is that a lot of these areas, these rural areas, have a lot of other natural resources. Briceño, for example, has a lot of gold. So these kind of more military policies allow the state to take control rather than developing rural economies.
State to take control in the interests of foreign capital to come in and extract minerals.
Exactly, which can be gold, or in the wake of the peace agreements, there's been major timber industries popping up in areas where they couldn't before.
As well, the displacement, of course, encouraging the growth of large landed estates. So this is for the elite and for foreign capital.
That's right.
That's quite extraordinary, being in that small community and all the large issues that are implicated. We've been talking with Alex Diamond. Really fascinating kind of experience. Thanks lots, Alex, for illuminating all this.
Thanks for having me.